From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Steady but not stellar. That's the message today from the government's monthly jobs report. While the economy added 175,000 jobs in May, the unemployment rate ticked up a notch to 7.6%. NPR's John Itzde explains.
The uptick in the unemployment rate in May is actually a somewhat positive indicator. Here's why. It rose not because the economy lost jobs, but rather because more people decided to look for work. Remember, the monthly unemployment report is based on two government surveys. In one, businesses report the number of jobs they've added to payrolls. But a different survey, one of households, provides the unemployment rate. Here's Gary Burtless, a labor economist at the Brookings Institution.
Employment rose robustly, according to that survey, so too did the number of people looking for work.
In fact, the number of new people looking for work overwhelmed the number who actually found jobs, so the unemployment rate ticked up a tenth to 7.6%. Some economists see that as a sign that workers who previously thought it wasn't worth looking for a job have decided that the economy is improving enough to make it worth their while. Burtless is not so sure about that. Overall, he says, today's report is what we've grown accustomed to in this recovery, steady but lackluster. In fact, the number of private sector jobs added to payrolls in May exactly matches the average monthly increase over the past 3 years.
The recovery just keeps plugging along. We worry about it sometimes. We think it's going to falter. We think it's going to end, but it just keeps chugging along.
That's true in the service sector. But manufacturing lost 8,000 jobs in May, the third straight month of declines. Chad Moutray, chief economist at the National Association of Manufacturers, says that's partly because of weak economies in our export markets. But Moutray says U.S. government budget cuts have also hurt.
You know, those across-the-board cuts have really hurt a lot of manufacturers, particularly those who are in the defense supply chain.
Moutray says he doesn't think today's report will change the Federal Reserve's view on stimulating the economy. He expects the Fed to begin winding down its stimulus sometime this summer. Stock investors liked what they saw. They drove the major stock indexes higher. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. Department of Labor says 175,000 new jobs were created last month, but the unemployment rate went up a tenth of a percent, and almost 20% of American workers are working only part-time, a historic high. Starting next year, businesses will be required to offer their full-time workers health coverage under the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, both by its supporters and opponents, but many business owners worry about how they'll pay for it. Clyde's Restaurant Group is a family-owned chain of 14 restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area. For half a century, Clyde's has been a meeting place for politicians and lobbyists, like those who passed this very legislation, to meet over drinks away from Capitol Hill. We visited the original Clyde's in Georgetown on Thursday night as the head chef prepped the waitstaff for dinner service.
Soup of the day. It's going to be a bacon corn chowder. We're still in peak season, about 3 weeks away from corn. But corn is still nice right now and still fresh.
Restaurants will face particular challenges. Most restaurant employees work for low wages supplemented by tips, leaving owners to pay a larger portion of the premiums to make health care affordable.
What we need to do now is we're going to take a field trip upstairs. We're going to talk about the insurance. You guys obviously know with 2014, the Obamacare, everybody has to have insurance by law. Okay.
Today, Clyde's is giving the waitstaff some information about the new law. They walk upstairs to the front office to watch a video.
Okay, guys. All right. Where's Charles at? He's coming.
All right. In this presentation, we will review relevant health care reform updates that will impact each of you in 2014, as well as review the four new CareFirst medical benefit plans.
All right, guys. I need you guys really to focus on this instead of eating. All right. I understand. You guys want to try the food? So this is what we're up here for. All right.
Now, most restaurants run on students who can use the money and people between jobs or those who need a second or third income to support their families. they may not want to pay more money for health care insurance. 75% of Clyde's staff is under the age of 26 and may not feel that they need coverage. Jeff Owens, who is Clyde's CFO, says he has to rethink his business plan.
It started out as a brainstorming exercise for us. We were able to sit in a room and without making any judgment, we would list out any ideas that was going to generate either cost savings or additional revenue. For example, someone might say, let's use paper napkins instead of cloth napkins, and so we put that on the list. And someone might say, let's reduce the portion size for our wild salmon. Instead of a 7-ounce portion, we're going to portion a 6-ounce portion, and we'll save some money there. The staffing, certainly that's part of the brainstorming. I mean, is there an opportunity to replace two shifts in the kitchen with one swing shift and save a few hours of payroll? We are all putting our heads together, and it's a real art to choose the ones that are going to be a good fit for us.
And then, of course, you can pass on cost to the customer, too.
And then that's right. So as our last item on the list is going to be how much of a price increase do we need to put onto our menu? It's a tricky thing because it's hard to forecast what the decrease in your traffic is going to be. It's interesting, someone had a creative idea is that we could start to charge our tipped employees for the credit card commission to collect the gratuities that their customers leave for them. The company spends probably $500,000 a year in credit card commissions for this tip income. I'm not saying we're implementing all of these things, but it's a real exercise to come up with a plan.
Now, Mr. Owens, what do you say to those people who might be listening, who might be saying, but wait, your restaurant group, along with other restaurants, made a considerable amount of money for years by not covering employees. And now you're going to be part of a plan that will be covering your employees and bring greater stability into their lives.
Well, I think it goes back to just the classic economic model of a restaurant. I can't just simplify it and say, if I gave everyone a 10 or a 12% pay cut, I would be able to pay for this new benefit. Or if I increased my menu prices by 6 or 7% across the board, I would be able to pay for this new benefit. It's really a matter of finding a way to be able to still operate under the new requirements.
May I ask if you considered increasing your prices and telling people why?
I've heard that idea from some other operators to just list an extra 5% surcharge and say this is for the healthcare benefit of all the employees. I don't suspect that we will end up going that route. We're going to figure out a way to make it work, and it's going to be part of our business model.
So to put you on the spot even a little more, Mr. Owens, how do you feel about these changes?
Well, it's a challenge, but it's not a challenge that we're going to run away from. Certainly other companies are looking at paying fines or different ways to structure the organization to fall under the 50-employee rule. For the last 2 to 3 years, it's been the number one issue on our radar and in conversations with our board of directors is the biggest challenge that we're facing. So we're not trying to run away from it, but it's a frightening proposition.
Not to put words in your mouth, is it possible to make it work? You will have to reduce the number of people who hold jobs.
Well, I think one thing that we'll be able to do is take advantage of folks that have limited availability. In the past, those folks have been hard for us to work with because they are a challenge for scheduling and training and so on. But by us figuring out a way to work with these folks, that we will have more part-time employees.
So this is, for example, the school teacher that can work Tuesday and Thursday nights for a few hours.
That's exactly right. And, it's not that we're going to take a full-time employee and convert them to a part-time employee, but we do have a lot of turnover in this business. So by just being open to working with the more part-time employees, that'll be one of those items that I mentioned that would contribute to the cost of the benefit.
Jeff Owens of the Clyde's Restaurant Group in Washington, D.C. The new health care coverage regulations go into effect next year. And you're listening to NPR News.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Tess Vigeland. For almost a century, it's been a tenet of the American dream. Work hard enough, and you'll get to rest and relax in your golden years. Travel, volunteer, see the grandchildren. It's a familiar image in TV ads for companies that manage retirement funds.
Your generation is definitely not headed for bingo night. In fact, you could write a book about how you're going to turn retirement upside down.
But retirement as we know it may be consigned to the dustbin of history. According to a new Pew study, Generation X, aged 38 to 47, is on track to be the first generation to do worse in retirement than its parents, assuming it retires at all. That's our cover story today, Rethinking Retirement, Gen X and Beyond.
I'm Michael Powers, 47 years old. I live in Washoe Valley, Nevada. I'm a carpenter slash cabinet maker slash woodworker, and I think I'll be retiring the day I die.
I'm Catherine Powers. I'm 46. I manage an office suites company, and I guess I'll be retired right after I die.
Michael and Catherine Powers are hardly alone. There is no other way to put this. Middle-aged Americans are in dire straits, with a median net worth of just $15,000. What was once a guaranteed notion of retirement at 65 is as antiquated as your grandmother's silver. The Powers have three children, and like many people of their generation, they didn't even start saving for retirement until well into their 30s.
We did start saving probably only about 15 years ago. I had a profit sharing with the construction company that I used to work for, but that's all gone now.
In 2007, business was booming. The housing bubble kept Michael busy, and the couple was able to save. They'd put away more than $15,000 when the crash came.
When the economy started failing, you know, we lost a whole bunch of the money that we had in, and, you know, we even at one point had to take some out.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was getting really bad there for a while.
2009 was the worst year. After Michael lost his job, they used the small retirement fund for daily living expenses. He says things are better now, but it's still tough to make ends meet.
I was making between $100,000 and $110,000 a year. And then now, last year, we made $30,000. You know, we're not poor. We're very thrifty. You know, we don't buy new things.
Which we would do anyway.
Yeah, which we would do mostly anyway. But There's no retirement. There's, you know, not a lot of extras happening.
Of that 15 grand they'd saved before the recession, only a tiny bit remains.
We have an IRA that has about $500 in it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. That's probably generous. $317 in Facebook stock, to be honest.
Gen X looks to be the first generation that will not exceed the wealth of the group that came before them and to potentially face downward mobility in retirement.
That's Aaron Currier with the Pew Charitable Trusts. Last month, they released a big study comparing the retirement savings of Generation X to previous generations, from baby boomers who are 48 to 65 years old, to Gen Xers.
What we did was look at replacement rates, which is how much savings and wealth a person will have to be able to replace their pre-retirement income. Most financial planners recommend being able to replace 70 to 100%. And the typical early boomer has acquired enough savings and wealth to replace between 70 and 80% of their income once they leave the labor market.
So they're right on target.
They're right on target. The typical late boomer will replace about 60%, which is a little bit insecure.
Mm-hmm.
But the typical Gen Xer is only on track to replace 50%.
Well, let's zero in on the Gen Xers. We are, five going on 6 years past the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. How much did that hurt this particular generation?
Well, the Great Recession absolutely took the largest toll on Gen X. They lost the highest percentage of net worth than the other groups, losing an average of $33,000 in their net worth. And they also took the biggest hit to their home equity in terms of percentage loss. So as a group, they definitely got hit. But even before the recession, there were signs that they were not on track to sort of exceed the wealth and the savings of the group that came immediately before them.
Aside from the Great Recession, let's talk about the retirement system itself and where that might be playing into this lack of retirement funding for Gen X. How much of a role does the 401k system play in all this?
That's a great question. What we know from the data is that less than half of Americans have access to a 401k through their employer, and a very small percentage of them try to get retirement plans on their own through an IRA. So for the group that is in the stock market, they've been able to, certainly they took a hit during the recession, but they've also been able to take advantage of some of the recovery that has occurred since. For people who are not engaged in any kind of retirement planning whatsoever, unless some dramatic change happens in terms of their savings rates and their ability to acquire wealth, there is going to be a substantive portion of the Gen X group that will not have a secure retirement.
And that does not bode well for Gen Y and the millennials.
No, it does not.
Aaron Currier of the Pew Charitable Trusts. Why is this generation having such a tough time? Well, they took out big loans for college, and wages have not kept up with the cost of living. But they also, for the most part, are doing without a retirement savings vehicle that previous generations had. Michael Powers, for one, misses it.
It's not like, you know, our grandparents had it with, you know, jobs with pensions. And, I mean, for a normal working person, you know, there are no jobs with pensions or insurance.
For most Americans under 50, the savings vehicle they're most likely to use is the 401k. Instead of a company automatically setting aside and managing a pension for you, the 401k allows workers, but does not require them, to invest their own money. Sometimes there's a company match. In theory, it gives you freedom.
Our experiment with the do-it-yourself, individual-directed, commercially provided 401k plan has not worked. It's a abysmal failure in almost every way, and almost all experts agree that something has to change.
Teresa Giller-Ducci studies retirement policy at the New School.
When people were retiring 15 years ago, many of those people who had pensions, and those were middle-class people and up, had defined benefit plans, which gave them a pension for life on top of their Social Security. 5 years later, into the mid-90s, 2000s, and now you're finding people who have a lump of money and their Social Security. And that lump, on average, is about $70,000 for people now just retiring. And they're told that they are supposed to handle that $70,000 for the rest of their lives. And they're also told that they may live until they're 92.
Teresa, if the pension system didn't work because there were promises made that couldn't be kept, companies that essentially did not do what they promised their workers they would do, and now the 401k system is not working because it counts too much on us to be wise and prudent with our money, what kind of system should we have?
What works is to go back to the basics. Make sure that people save where they can save, and that's at the workplace. And you start at the very beginning of your work life, and you contribute a little bit. If you start like 5%, if you start saving at 45, you have to save 10 or more percent of your income. If you start at 50, it's not too late, but you have to ratchet down your spending and really ratchet up your savings to almost 25%.
But Teresa, don't we know at this point that people aren't built to save on their own?
Yes, Tess, you're right. Human beings cannot be told to withhold their consumption when everyone else around them is consuming, and the place where they would save their money isn't safe. So there has to be new institutions that guarantee a modest but safe continual rate of return. And we can do that by adding to the Social Security system a place where people can save their money and get a rate of return that's safe, maybe 3%. Or states, Tess, are looking into ways that their residents can save money through the public employees' retirement systems in the states. Oregon, Connecticut, Maryland, New York, Washington are all states that are looking into statewide options to the 401k system.
Teresa Giller-Ducci, director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School. For all the efforts in enhancing the retirement system on the state level, most reforms will come too late for people now in their late 30s and 40s, meaning people like Catherine Powers may have to revise their vision for retirement.
We've been married for 26 years. It would be nice just go on road trips together and spend time alone together since we've had a child in the house for over 22 years now.
And missing out on that part of life isn't just bad for the Powers. Analyst Teresa Ghilarducci says it's bad for all of us.
This idea of whether or not we are entitled to retirement is a great question. After the Great Depression, there was this idea that everybody deserves some time to themselves to decide what they do with their time. They got the weekend, they got holidays, and they got retirement. And to me, that's one of the most precious periods of our life, because we're going to die after that period, and we need some time to connect to not only the people that we love, but what psychologists call, we need a time to create a personal narrative about what our life meant.
A concept of our golden years that increasingly feels like a mirage.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Here in the U.S., June is known as Gay and Lesbian Pride Month, recognizing the contributions and concerns of LGBT people in this country. Later, we'll talk with two people on the cutting edge of what's become one of the markers of LGBT progress. They are the authors of a new book about how to photograph same-sex weddings. There are some interesting similarities and differences that might surprise you. But first, speaking of weddings, here's a clip from a recent episode of Saturday Night Live.
That's why I use Xanax for gay summer weddings.
Because your gay friends have it all figured out, and you don't.
At my wedding, we gave guests Cheez-Its and a mini bottle of water. Keith and William gave us 2 tickets to Italy and $40,000.
And if you saw this skit, then you know it's playing off what seems to be the widely held idea that gay couples are better off than most couples. Now, though, there's a new study from the Williams Institute that shows that poverty rates are actually higher for same-sex couples than for straight couples. We wanted to hear more about that, so we've called Professor Lee Badgett. She's the research director at the Williams Institute. That's a research institute at UCLA Law School that focuses on LGBT issues. She's also an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and she's with us now from member station New England Public Radio. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So is the overall picture here that same-sex couples are more likely to be poorer than straight couples?
Yes, we do see that same-sex couples are much more likely to be poor. And even when we look at people who are not in same-sex couples, we have some data on lesbian and bisexual individuals. We also see that they're more likely to be poor.
But let's focus on couples, though, because I think it's understood that marriage, being a couple, is often kind of a bulwark against poverty, right? Or a hedge against poverty because you have two incomes to draw on when sort of times get tough. Are there certain same-sex couples that are more likely to be poor, for example? Are lesbians more likely to be poor than men? Are African-Americans more likely to be poor than white couples?
We definitely see some subgroups who are more likely to be poor, and you hit on two of them. Lesbian couples in particular are combining two women's incomes instead of a man and a woman's income, and that means that they will just have lower than average incomes in general. So they are more likely to be poor. We do see that African-Americans are more likely to be poor than our married different-sex African-American couples, but they're also more likely to be poor than white same-sex couples, so they seem to get a double whammy.
What about white gay male couples?
They seem to be doing pretty well when you just look at their overall poverty rate. So we wanted to dig a little bit deeper, and we compared white gay men and African-American gay male couples, all the different kinds of couples, and tried to hold constant or to take into account all the things that influence people's poverty rates. So they have higher levels of education. They're less likely to have kids. Those are things that tend to protect people from poverty. But once we were comparing apples to apples, we found that the gay male couples are more likely to be poor.
Any idea why that is?
There are a couple of possibilities. One that I think you have to think hard about is the fact that there is likely to be discrimination in the workplace against lesbian, gay, and bisexual people. And discrimination usually goes along with lower earnings, and we do see that for gay and bisexual men in particular in the labor force. It also comes with a higher likelihood of losing your job, and that's a big predictor of poverty. So I think that's likely to be one of the biggest factors driving these differences.
Why don't we wheel it around, though? Just referencing that Saturday Night Live skit. I mean, part of the reason that it's funny is that people think it's true, right? So why is there this image of LGBT couples being not just okay, but really well off?
Well, that clip that you played was one great example about why in the media, those are the people that you see. Those are the gay and lesbian people you see. They have good jobs. They have nice homes. There have, over the last couple of decades, been other people pushing this image. People who oppose civil rights laws for gay and lesbian people often will point to that image and say, hey, you know, gay people aren't a real minority. They're doing really well. And even in the gay community itself, sometimes there are people who point to that image to say, hey, we're a great marketing niche. You should have your company target our population. So there are lots of different people trying to promote that image, both intentionally and unintentionally.
You think part of it is that the people who tend to be most visible, at least on the, maybe let's just say in the forward flanks, right, of the gay community in terms of people who are visible, they tend to be what, artists or people who are very successful business people? Is that
exactly.
It?
Exactly. Yeah. Big actors, big name actors, the Neil Patrick Harris, you know, who was just on the Tonys last night. I mean, if that's your image, if you don't know any other gay or lesbian people and you're thinking, who pops into my head when I think of that term, it's likely to be those people who are out in front of the media, or Tammy Baldwin in the Senate. You know, people who look powerful and who look like they're doing pretty well for themselves, and they are, but they're just not typical of the whole gay and lesbian population.
That's what I wanted to ask you. So why do you think this new information matters? Why do you think it's important to pay attention to? Because there's a lot of talk now about, you know, the whole question of positive stereotypes versus negative stereotypes. Some people feel that positive stereotypes aren't so bad because if it causes people to look at you with a little bit more respect, maybe, than they would otherwise, what's so terrible? So why do you think this information is important?
Well, stereotypes definitely can cut both ways. And I think in this case, what looks like a positive stereotype can really hold back a discussion about public policy, about the fact that we don't have any kind of federal protections against discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And I think that's one place where this stereotype gets in the way of an important discussion. And then, you know, we're still grappling with issues around poverty and, you know, where there's a big debate about funding for food stamps, for instance. And that, I think, what we see in this report is that that's a gay issue too, just like employment discrimination. So our hope is that when people in the gay community are thinking about poverty issues, they're thinking, yeah, this is important for us too. And when people in the poverty world are thinking, you know, who are our clients, that they're also recognizing that they have same-sex couples and gay and lesbian people and bisexual people and transgender people in their clientele, and they're trying to make sure that their services are welcoming to those folks as well.
That was Lee Badgett. She is the research director at the Williams Institute, and she's also economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Professor Badgett, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.